Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is John Kalambakides. John is a research biologist, and he's one of the founders of Cascadia Research, which is a nonprofit research organization. They're based in Olympia. And John has done long-term research on the status and movements and behavior of blue whales, humpback whales, gray whales, focusing a lot in the Pacific Northwest. And John will be the lecturer at the next Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Ocean series, where he will talk about gray whales in Washington State. Welcome, John. Glad you can join us.
Nice to see you.
Well, before we go any further, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Quick hint, that is not a conga drummer. We'll come back later in the show and talk about what that sound actually is. And we'll be focusing on gray whales. I'm in Loreto, Mexico. Loreto is on the Gulf of California, about two-thirds or so away down the Baja Peninsula. Came here to snorkel, to be in the sun, and to watch whales. And we've seen humpbacks. We saw one fin whale, have seen lots of bottlenose dolphins. We're disappointed, really, really wanted to see a blue whale. They do come into the Gulf of California this time of year to feed. But just last week, apparently a bunch of orcas came in and the blue whales got a bit freaked out and have scattered. The other thing we did is we went across the peninsula to the Pacific side to watch gray whales over in Magdalena Bay. So this is going to be about gray whales.
Nan, I'm just going to make a little comment that I've actually studied blue whales out of Magdalena Bay.
Have you really?
Yeah. So even though Magdalena Bay itself is primarily an area used by gray whales, just outside of the bay and a little bit north, an area called Punta San Lazaro in Santa Maria Bay is an area that actually my wife and I set up a field camp. This is 20 or so years ago, primarily to study blue whales. And we encountered quite a few blue whales. And even though blue whales are primarily, you know, seen and whale watching is conducted for them in areas like out of Loreto and La Paz on the Gulf side, the west side of Baja is actually one of the more heavily used areas by blue whales.
And we suspect
is a really important area for blue whales in the winter months. In that work I did, we found something like 50 blue whales in that work. And it was this time of year. And my wife also did a cruise up the west coast of Baja on a sailboat surveying for blue whales and encountered well over 100 in that cruise. So that doesn't tend to happen out of Magdalena Bay because you have to go outside the bay, but mm-hmm. just let you know you're actually close to blue whales in your neck.
I was astounded. I had no idea you could see blue whales essentially from a land base. I thought they mostly roamed the open oceans and never in my life would I see a blue whale, the largest animal ever known to have lived on Earth, I believe.
Yes.
But back to gray whales, which we did see. I'm curious to ask you, John, a bit about the migration patterns. And here in Baja, we're sort of close to the southern end of their migration, and they migrate up from here up the coast of North America and into the Arctic, into the Chukchi and the Bering Sea. And I read just recently that that's the longest migration of any mammal. And so I'm wondering, what's the adaptive advantage of that? I mean, why spend the energy it takes to do that kind of a migration and be exposed to, I know, various risks and threats. What's the ecology or what's the behavior behind that?
Yes. And, you know, and it's a behavior seen in a lot of the baleen whales to make these annual migrations. And it's actually been the subject of a sometimes heated debate, even in the scientific community, about what are the, you know, the driving factors for that seasonal migration. You know, and there's been maybe a little bit of a settlement of that argument in that the debate initially focused on, you know, are baleen whales migrating to southern breeding areas to be in warmer temperatures to give, you know, less of a, you know, an energetic challenge to their calves so they can be born in warm waters? Or was the migration primarily driven by avoiding areas of high killer whale attack and predation, which tend to focus on the calves? So it would make the kind of birthing and early nursing period the most sensitive time for large baleen whales. And there's a third factor at work, which is just to point out the larger baleen whales rely on filter feeding. And one of the interesting things about filter feeding is that depending on the density of prey, it can either be an incredibly efficient, you know, energetically effective way to feed if densities are high and you're getting high concentrations of your prey when you try to engulf them. But it can also be, if densities of prey are low, it can also be a negative energetic advantage. You could expend more energy trying to engulf. And if you're only getting a few prey as you try to filter feed, you can expend more energy than it's worth. So I'm going to put those three things together and say that most baleen whales migrate south partly because the most productive periods for them to feed are in spring, summer, and fall. That's when there's the most upwelling in productivity. And in winter is when maybe there's the least payoff to being able to feed, and makes it, you know, therefore not very costly for them to potentially migrate to a non-feeding area. I think there is an energetic advantage to calves, you know, being born in warmer waters. But I do think that what's emerged is, if anything, something that strengthens the argument that avoiding killer whale predation of their calves is a very important force driving that migration. And that's maybe clearly demonstrated by gray whales and the fact that, you know, the mothers and their calves disproportionately come in and use these shallow water lagoons that are
where the orcas apparently don't come into the shallow water. Right.
Or have only been rarely documented. Rarely. There have been a few cases, but it does seem like all of those factors may be at work.
I had kind of guessed it was just food related, but it's much more complex.
Yes, and multiple factors. And with some species like blue whales, it actually looks like they're migrating to areas in the south, including the Gulf of California or that area off West Baja or the Costa Rica Dome. They're actually migrating to warm water southern areas that are productive and where they actually continue to feed. So they're not actually even giving up feeding by coming south. So they are, you know, not necessarily trading that off. Gray whales are the more extreme example where they seem to be heavily giving up feeding, though a lot of our research has also shown that, you know, contrary to maybe our more monolithic view that they don't feed during migration, it does look like often they'll engage in feeding behavior in other areas where there are opportunities to feed. So sometimes they are able to take advantage of feeding in these areas on migration as well. So they're not totally giving up feeding necessarily.
That's interesting too, because I remember hearing quite some time ago that they didn't feed during migration, but your research is showing that there is some feeding that goes on.
Yes, and it's especially become dramatic. You know, the overall gray whale population has at several points in time, and most recently starting in 2019, experienced these high mortality events. They're termed unusual mortality events by NOAA and are actually declared as such. And gray whales have been under an unusual mortality event since 2019. And most of the animals dying are in very poor nutritional condition, So the leading hypothesis of what's driving this unusual mortality event is this is the result of, you know, an increasing large gray whale population really being challenged by finding enough food in the Arctic. And especially in that scenario, we're seeing more and more gray whales feeding under northern migration. That's included one of the groups of whales I study called the Sounders gray whales that come into Puget Sound.
Yeah, that feed off Whidbey, yeah.
We've seen their numbers more than double just since that 2019 event. Initially, we documented this in the early 90s by six whales. Then it became 12 whales in 1999, 2000, which was an unusual mortality event pair of years. A couple of those animals appear to have died, so we were down to about 10. And currently, we're up to just over 20 with the new whales that have joined them in this most recent unusual mortality event. And that just seems to be one example in areas of herring spawn, especially off West Vancouver Island. In springtime during the northern migration, they're sometimes seeing hundreds of whales coming into some of these areas. And most of those seem to be migrating whales that are stopping off to feed on herring spawn before continuing their migration. Mm. So I think especially during this period of nutritional stress and this unusual mortality event, we've seen more of that evidence of feeding on migration, especially the northern migration.
So Neil, I'm curious too. I mean, we hear, you know, the various impacts, of course, of climate change and how much the Arctic is changing in terms of water temperatures and ice and presumably productivity. What are you and other scientists thinking about the possible impacts on the migrating grays?
No, and I think that's been really the million-dollar question, if you will. Because of those dramatic changes in the Arctic, we've really worried about how it's that affected gray whales. And there is work by a researcher, Jackie Grebmeier, who has studied the populations of some of the prey of gray whales up in the Arctic. And she's seen declines in the prey in some of the traditional areas gray whales used to feed. But the reason why the question has become tricky is because it's complicated. If anything, and this was research that even predated some of these more dramatic changes in the Arctic, what was showing up in monitoring gray whale reproductive success was that in the years with lower ice cover, the gray whales seem to do better and have more calves the following year. So that's one of the tricky things. These changes in the Arctic may be wreaking very significant and potentially long-term consequences to gray whales. But in the short term, there's also a way it's benefited gray whales by opening up areas that they haven't been able to access. Gray whales going into farther north waters that are usually, you know, clogged by ice and not accessible to them, and they can access them earlier and for longer during this period of lower ice. So I think multiple things might be going on: short-term increased access to prey, but also these dramatic changes in the Arctic affecting prey densities in areas in ways that are more complicated. And I would say that question is unresolved, other than we've seen that it's not a simple relationship.
Mm-hmm, as is often many things in biology and ecology. I was also thinking about the nursery grounds. Obviously, I'm down here. Curious why there are so few areas. I'm kind of wondering, is that a function of topography and geography? Or because basically you consider like three basic areas where they breed and have their nurseries along the Pacific coast of the Baja Peninsula. So why are they just three?
Yes. and again, that may come to that orca predation question, because the lagoons that you mentioned, the three areas, are selectively and primarily used by mothers with calves. And if you survey, which I've done along the west coast of Baja outside the lagoons, there are lots of gray whales outside the lagoons. You know, most of the single and other adult animals are actually outside the lagoons. And that's what really also tends to reinforce this conclusion that part of the use of the lagoons is to try to get into waters where they're protected from killer whales, and primarily the newborn calves are protected from killer whales, because during that northern migration, when those calves leave the lagoons, they are then subjected to a pretty high rate of predatory threat. And especially in areas where they cross deep water canyons, which include in Monterey Bay, but also up in the Aleutian Islands, there are areas that serve as bottlenecks that the, the killer whales take advantage of and will, again, heavily target some of the mothers with calves. So the calves are, of course, bigger than and not as vulnerable as they would be in that period there in the lagoons.
Certainly most of the animals we saw were mothers and calves. And they come to the boats. You sort of cool the engines, sit and wait for them. They do come. I'm curious as well. Some of the locals down here talk about the grays or the friendly whales. So I'd like your perspective on the behavior, because it appears like the mothers are introducing their calves to humans in boats. What's your thought on that behavior?
Yeah, and I'll basically say I don't get it.
Okay.
most of my experience, because I haven't spent much time in the lagoons, has been with humpback whales. And when I first started studying humpback whales in the 1980s on the U.S. West Coast, we didn't have very many friendly encounters from the humpback whales. But starting in the 1990s, that became more and more common with humpback whales off the U.S. West Coast, to the point that it actually kind of reached a peak and then declined. But, you know, I've spent time in our small soft bottom inflatable where I was lifted in the air and spun around on the back of two humpback whales that just played with me like a toy for over an hour in the Santa Barbara Channel. And I've had kind of friendly humpback whales approach me. And when that happens, I just have to scratch my head. When experiencing that, I'm still sort of, okay, well, maybe we can go with an explanation that, you know, one of humpback whales' claim to fame is that they develop social and innovative ways to cooperate and feed. And maybe part of that, you know, is interacting with things in their environment, you know, but all of that feels like a stretch when you're experiencing it. It just seems like curiosity is what feels like, but I don't have a great scientific
explanation. Yeah, curiosity and playfulness.
Why, you know, it's almost more puzzling if gray whales, mothers and their calves are going to the lagoons to protect their calves and avoid killer whale predation, is that's one of their driving forces, why they would be bringing calves up to boats and what, you know, has been a threat to them in the
past. Of course, whaling was a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Seems even more puzzling. I can't explain.
Well, it's another one of those questions that may not have an explanation. Oh, this is maybe a bit off the wall, but something that really surprised me is when they expelled through their blowholes. First of all, I was astounded. I didn't realize that baleens had two sort of nasal openings and toothed whales only had one. I hadn't realized that. But when we were exposed to the breath, I was surprised that it had no smell, no taste. It was just like mist. And you hear things about whales having rather foul breaths. And I'm now guessing maybe is that the toothed whales?
We've certainly, the thing I found, and we spend a lot of time often, you know, exposed to that breath as well. And what I'm surprised at is there's quite a bit of variability. And you'll have whales where there is no pungent or, you know, other odor, and then you'll have others. I don't know. We worked with a guy used to call them stinkers. You know, the ones that, you know, had this really strong smell, and he was interested in trying to document, is that the result of, you know, some type of metabolic process, you know, fasting, or maybe some kind of bacterial growth, and it wasn't really resolved.
Yeah, I mean, it was just really interesting that
yes.
that it was like, whoa, yeah. There's no smell or taste here.
Yeah, I mean, the blowholes are quite amazing in the fact that these animals exchange this huge amount of air in this very short interval, and they open these blowholes to, be able to exhale and then inhale rapidly, but also the huge muscles that then have to keep those closed because they're going to dive deep and not want any water leaching in. So they're really an amazing adaptation in and of themselves.
I was really amazed to look at. I had never been that close to the blowholes. And it was amazing. And yes, I can say no more. It was amazing. And I'm just realizing we could talk a lot more, but we may be getting close to our time. Well, as I mentioned earlier, John is giving the next Future of the Oceans lecture series for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. It'll be Sunday, March the 12th, in the chapel at Fort Worden. And the title of that talk is Gray Whales in Washington State, Three Groups, Three Stories, From Death to Promise. So, John, give us a little teaser. What are you going to talk about?
Yes, no. And as a broader intro, I will just say that, gray whales to many researchers, including myself, were viewed as maybe a species we had figured out. It had this very regimented migration, this highly specialized way to feed, these very distinct breeding lagoons, this long migration. And I think what has emerged, especially in my research in Washington State, is an appreciation for how complicated and varied they are. Mm. The actual number of prey types documented that gray whales eat exceeds that of any other baleen whale. They're actually incredibly versatile feeders. They don't just feed on the bottom. They can even feed on krill, herring larvae, crabs, all these different prey types. So they have proven themselves to be quite adaptive and versatile. And along with that has been that not only do we have this larger population that migrates past Washington State, engages in that long migration, but we have this group called the Pacific Coast Feeding Group that spends the spring, summer, and fall feeding in the Pacific Northwest, primarily on the outer coast. The west coast of Vancouver Island is sort of the center of their range. They appear to be a somewhat distinctive group. They go down to Baja and interbreed, but those animals engage in that behavior year after year. And you can actually find certain significant differences in the proportion of mitochondrial DNA, that shows they've been at least somewhat isolated into these maternal groups. And mitochondrial DNA is passed on from mother to offspring. So it really reflects that many of these whales learn to feed in this way from having gone there with their mother and then become part of that group. And we've documented that. So on the one hand, we have the larger population. It's the one facing this unusual mortality event. Probably a quarter or a third of the animals may have died in some of these unusual mortality events. It has big impacts on them. We have this smaller group of about 250 whales, the Pacific Coast Feeding Group that I just mentioned. They engage in this whole other feeding, don't tend to migrate north, and have kind of carved out a little special area in the Pacific Northwest. And then we have this third group, the Sounders whales, which are gray whales primarily that have learned to break off from the migration, come and feed in this Whidbey Island area in the spring months before continuing migration. And it's over 100 miles off their migration. Mm-hmm. We think we've identified why they do this. It is in years where that population is facing nutritional stress that, they've come into these new areas. That's when gray whales, I think, okay, I'm not doing as well in the Arctic. It's time for me to look for other opportunities.
Look for other places. And they
take chances exploring new areas. Yeah. And if they find them, the amazing thing about the Sounders is that individual, like Earhart, one of the individuals that's there right now feeding, showed up early this year to feed. We've documented her coming, the vast majority of years since 1990. So over 30 years.
Wow.
She's been coming back to this area, and she comes back and feeds to the exact same spots. So they have an amazing memory to know to come back to this exact spot. So once they learn and find a productive area, and maybe this is a product of if you're feeding on the bottom, that tends to be a more stable prey that will be there. They know to zero in and come back.
You are just tickling the fancies of the audience to Nature Now, and we hope they'll come out to see your talk at the Marine Science Center next Sunday, the 12th. Couple of things. We need to go back to the mystery sound. So let's hear that mystery sound again. So those are, surprisingly, those are gray whales. Those are the conga calls of the gray whales, which I understand are one of the most frequently heard sounds. And I'm going to ask John, have you heard those? And actually, I want to know, too, if you could hear the sounds of the gray whales when you're in a boat or when you're not underwater. Can you hear the sounds?
Yeah, I have not heard them ever other than with a hydrophone or on the recording on one of the tags that we put on a whale. And I will just say that gray whale vocalizations haven't been as well studied as many of the other baleen whales. So one of the things we'll be doing this year and I'm trying to do more of is get more data on the acoustics of gray whales, especially the sounders, gray whales. And so some of the tags we're putting on them now have high quality hydrophones to record their sounds.
That'll be fascinating to learn, won't it?
We're just, pardon the pun, tuning into that more now.
Well, thank you so much, John, for joining us. And I also want to thank Nora Petrich, our sound engineer and sound editor, and thank all the listeners for listening in. And our ending music for today is The Raging Sea by The Elders.
She's smiling now, carried to the room with the fishes on the wall now.
Wanna walk, wanna go to the sea now.
Looking at the boats and looking at the sky.
I would learn to fish, I would learn to fly.
Got a better fisherman than I'll ever be.
Riding his boat on the raging sea. Da-dee-dee-dee-dum, da-dee-dee-boom-boom-da.
Hey!